I thought we'd talk about the cost of discipleship system today, which I haven't done as yet. And a lot of you know that book. I guess they're out of it in the bookstore, but it's in the meditation library. And most of you know, if you've looked at it at all, that it is a commentary, kind of, on the Sermon on the Mount, plus some introductory and supplementary essays. So I thought we'd spend a little bit of time getting some backdrop on the Sermon on the Mount, and then we would talk about how Bonhoeffer deals with the Sermon on the Mount, and then maybe spell out some implications of that, and I hope we have some time for some conversation. I think we can easily manage that today. Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5, 6, and 7, as you well know. And it is probably the portion of the New Testament that is best known, both inside and outside the church. It is certainly the passage of the New Testament which is quoted more than any other passage. It is one of the very few sections of the New Testament that has commentaries written on it. I mean, there's no commentary, as far as I know, a whole book written on the second and third chapter of Galatians or something like this. But Matthew 5, 6, and 7 are lifted out of the Gospel of Matthew, and you can go in any theological library and there are shelves full of books written on the Sermon on the Mount. There's no other passage in the whole New Testament that has been handled in that way. The church fathers, the mucky monks in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, Augustine and Irenaeus and Cyprian and all of these people, quote the Sermon on the Mount more than any other passage in the New Testament. And it is a passage that is used by non-Christians as well. Jewish scholars talk about the Sermon on the Mount as the finest flower of Jewish ethics. No problem at all with the Sermon on the Mount. They say if we could only get rid of all of the Jesus junk that the church puts in there, we could go with the Sermon on the Mount no problem. Gandhi, you probably know, built his whole philosophy and outlook on life and political activity on a combination of the Sermon on the Mount and the Bhagavad Gita. He said the problem is that the Christians don't live up to the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is great. And you take Sermon on the Mount and the Bhagavad Gita and you have Gandhi. In the pericope system, or the assigned texts for the Sundays of the church year, which are followed in the Roman Catholic Church and Lutheran Church, and I don't know if the Presbyterians in Santa Monica do that or not, but they do in other places in the country, follow assigned texts. To some extent, the Sermon on the Mount has more texts in that series than any other three-chapter segment of the New Testament. Well, that just means that when we're dealing with the Sermon on the Mount, we're dealing with a unique segment of the New Testament. And so that's one thing to say about it. Another thing to say about the Sermon on the Mount is that there are some peculiar structural and formal problems if one is going to handle it in an exegetical way, or asking what does that mean in the context of the Gospel of Matthew. For instance, some of you know that there is in the Gospel of Luke a thing called sometimes the Sermon on the Plain, and that is a segment of Luke's Gospel that contains about half of the material that is contained in the Sermon on the Mount. And it's called the Sermon on the Plain because it's introduced with a comment about Jesus standing on the plain. And in Matthew, he goes up to the mountain. So it's called Sermon on the Mountain, Sermon on the Plain. And the Sermon on the Plain is about half as long, and the material is roughly half of the Sermon on the Mount. The rest of the Sermon on the Mount, that is, that's not included in the Sermon on the Plain, is found scattered helter-skelter throughout Luke, and pieces of it are found helter-skelter throughout Mark, very little of it in John. So you're confronted immediately by the fact that the Sermon on the Mount is a construction by Matthew or the people with whom Matthew lived, taking pieces and chunks of things that Jesus said and just putting them together. So, I mean, I suppose it's possible that Jesus walked up to a mountain and said these words, but it's highly unlikely. Unless you're going to say that Luke cut it in half and put them on the plain and put a piece down and put it in different contexts and so on. So the Sermon on the Mount drives one to a recognition of the fact that the New Testament witnesses, the gospel writers, always bear witness to Christ for a specific purpose and through the medium of their own particular slant on things. There is no such thing as a simple photograph of Jesus or a tape recording of Jesus. All the stuff comes to us filtered through the early church. So the way in which Matthew puts that stuff together then becomes of some significance. And Matthew writes to an essentially Jewish audience, and he quotes a lot of Old Testament. You know that Jesus in Matthew is always quoting the Old Testament, a lot more so, for instance, than in John's Gospel. And there is a pattern in Matthew's Gospel where there are long discourses, and at the end of each discourse, there is a set phrase, "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings." And that occurs at the end of chapter 7. And that occurs five times in Matthew's Gospel. So there's a huge discourse, the first of which is the Sermon on the Mount, and it says, "Now when Jesus has finished these sayings," then he does some other stuff, and then he starts talking again. And then it says, "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings," and then he does some other stuff, and then another long discourse, and it says, "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings." Well, that's a structural device on the part of Matthew to organize his particular gospel. And it so happens that there are five of those things in the Gospel of Matthew. And it so happens that Matthew writes to the Jews. And so there are a lot of people who say Matthew is a Jewish gospel, and what Matthew is doing is to say that Jesus is the new Moses. There are the five books of Moses, and Matthew arranges his material in five sections. So Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. And then you have in the Sermon on the Mount that neat section where Jesus says, "You have heard it said of old," he quotes the Old Testament, "but I say to you." So you have the whole relationship between old and new, between Moses and Jesus, Old Testament and New Testament, the five books of Moses and the five books of Matthew. Now, there are other people who say, no, that's not really the case, but that's at least one of the issues that one takes into consideration. And how one interprets the Sermon on the Mount is, of course, affected by how one looks at structure, because if one really does think that Jesus is the new Moses, then you can think of Jesus as the new lawgiver. Now, that's a very un-Lutheran way to think about Jesus, because Jesus is the grace giver, not the lawgiver. Jesus is contrasted with Moses. He's not an extension of Moses. So that's an issue. Another issue in the Sermon on the Mount is that at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, verse 1, it says, Jesus took his disciples up there, his disciples sat down, and he opened his mouth and said, and you get the idea that all that stuff is said to his disciples. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, it says, and the crowds were astonished. Now, you don't know, really, to whom those little pieces were said, but you can ask the question, for whom did Matthew arrange that material? And if the stuff is inner circle stuff, just for the disciples, then it's a kind of a for believers only ethic. But if it's for the crowds, then it's a kind of a public ethic for everybody, believers or unbelievers. So that these kinds of structural issues in the Sermon on the Mount have led then, in the history of the church, of course, to many different ways of interpreting the Sermon on the Mount. And let me give you a few of those. There is a way of reading the Sermon on the Mount which is literalistic, which is absolutistic, which says, and this would be based on the fact that the crowds were astonished. It was said to everybody. This is a public ethic. This is not just for Christians. The whole world should live according to the Sermon on the Mount, whether you believe in Jesus or not. And Tolstoy is an example of this kind of reading on the Sermon on the Mount. It says, judge not that you be not judged. Tolstoy said that means out with the law courts. Turn the other cheek. That means out with the police force and the military. Don't swear. That means out with the law courts. This is the last part of Tolstoy's life. So Tolstoy said, doesn't matter whether you think that's practical or not, or whether you think it'll work. That's beside the point. The point is that Jesus said that's the way people are to live, and that's the way people are to live, and so let's structure society that way. You have people like Jehovah's Witnesses, or let's take some of the Mennonites, some of the radical Mennonite groups, the Amish people, tend to read the Sermon on the Mount in a very literalistic and absolutistic way. Okay, that's one way. You don't ask whether it makes sense, you don't ask whether it's practical, you don't ask whether you can do it, or you don't ask whether you've seen many people doing it. It's the law, Jesus says so, it's right, and that's the way we're to act. That's one way to read it. Another way that people have latched on to the Sermon on the Mount is that they have noticed some little items in here that are very, very convenient little escape clauses. For instance, in chapter 5, verse 22, it says, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. There's a little, in your Revised Standard Version, there's a little mark there, and in the footnote it says, other ancient authorities insert without cause. Now, other ancient authorities, that means that what we have between the black covers on India paper is a decision made by an editor or editors, not only about translation, but about what text to translate. There are maybe 5,000 manuscripts of the New Testament, and no two of those are identical. The autographs, the thing that was originally written by Matthew, that's long gone. All you have is copies and copies and copies and copies and copies and copies. And before the invention of movable type, everything is done by hand, obviously. And when a truck goes by, you know, the guy looks over and he looks back and he picks it up at a different place from where he was at the beginning. I mean, if you've ever read a newspaper, you know that people who are trained copy editors and proofreaders make those same mistakes. You can hardly, I've never seen a newspaper without some kinds of errors in it. I edit a theological journal, and I read that manuscript, the managing editor reads it, the linotypist reads it, you have professional proofreaders, and I don't think we've put out an edition yet without mistakes in it. Well, that happens with the transmission of the text. And so you've got some poor characters who spend their lives with little green shades and a naked light bulb, you know, at a desk and fussing around with all these manuscripts and making decisions by dating the manuscripts, by comparing one manuscript with another, by grouping them in families, make decisions about what was originally written. So when you see in the margin other ancient authorities read, that means that the editors are not really sure whether that phrase ought to be was in the original text or not. They've decided it wasn't there, but they put it in the margin for you. So it says, whoever is angry with his brother, and for sure there are piles of manuscripts that add without cause, is liable to the judgment. Now, what that means is that very, very early in the life of the church, the Christians who read this stuff said, come on, Jesus, you are putting us on. See? You can't mean always. Obviously, you can't mean always. So, whoever is angry with his brother, comma, without cause, comma, is liable. In the statement on divorce in Matthew, it says, but I say to you, everyone who divorces his wife, comma, except on the ground of unchastity, comma, makes her an adulteress. In that case, it's not in the margin, it's in the text. But it's in the text of Matthew, it's not in the text of Mark. So when you read Mark, it says whoever divorces his wife makes her an adulteress, period. But Mark is an earlier gospel than Matthew. And in the few years of the transmission of the words of Jesus, the oral transmission of the words of Jesus, the church said, well, come on, there are some exceptions to that rule. So, comma, except on the ground of unchastity, comma. Now that's a way of reading the Sermon on the Mount based on actual textual material that says this stuff is not as absolute as it sounds. What it means is that's a general rule, but obviously there are exceptions. So turn the other cheek, comma, unless he hits you too hard, comma. You can do that. You can throw in stuff between commas in every single one of those statements that Jesus makes, and you can do it not out of your own head, but you can do it on the basis of the actual words of the text in the early church. So that is a non-absolutistic way of reading the Sermon on the Mount. That's a way of saying that Jesus is giving us kind of general guidelines, general principles, but obviously there are exceptions. Okay, another way in which the Sermon on the Mount has been read is in the Roman Catholic tradition, there is a whole structure of reading the world and God and the Bible and church and everything else, which is a two-decker affair, which begins with nature and moves to grace. All of Roman Catholic life and thought is built on that structure. That's Thomas Aquinas, it's called Thomism. And Thomas says, Grace never destroys nature, but it always fulfills nature. Grace fulfills nature. That means there is a natural movement from nature to grace. Now that works out in all kinds of ways. Natural law to revealed law, reason to revelation. That's what the Reformation was all about. Luther says it doesn't go from nature to grace, but it goes down from God to man. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is set in that same framework, and Thomas took the word of Jesus to the rich young man from the Gospel of Matthew, where he comes and says, Jesus, what's the first great commandment? What shall I do? And Jesus says, come on, you know the commandments. And he says, yes, I've always obeyed those from my youth. And Jesus says, bully for you. Now, if you want to be perfect, then go sell what you have and give to the poor. Now, it isn't like that in Mark or Luke. I guess it's Luke. Jesus says, obey the commandments and give to the poor, and that's all together. But in Matthew, there seems to be a separation. So he says, obey the commandments, that's great, but if you want to be perfect. So what Thomas did is to put ethics on two layers too, and he called the commandments the precepts, I hope I've got that right, and he called the Sermon on the Mount stuff the councils, the evangelical councils. And the precepts, the Ten Commandments, are for your everyday, ordinary, common, slob Christian. You know, everybody has to obey the commandments. But if you want to be perfect, if you want to be a super Christian, then you obey the evangelical councils. That means that the Sermon on the Mount is not applicable to the everyday, ordinary Christian. The Sermon on the Mount is applicable to the guy who takes the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now that's another way of handling the Sermon on the Mount. Luther was fighting on two fronts all the time. He was fighting against, on the one hand, the left wing, Anabaptists, Peasants' Revolt, the Schrammerei, the enthusiasts. Now, on the other hand, he was fighting the Roman Catholic Church. And in his interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount, he is very careful to try to steer clear of both of those people. Now, Luther, as you know, is a very genteel and soft-spoken guy. And so he doesn't want to step on anyone's toes, and you have to listen very carefully to find out, you know, kind of where his head is at. And so when he writes on the Sermon on the Mount, he says, first, this fifth chapter has fallen into the hands of vulgar pigs and asses, a jurist and sophist, the right hand of that jackass of a pope and his mamelukes. Out of this beautiful rose they have sucked and broadcast poison, covering up Christ with it, and elevating and maintaining Antichrist. Now he's talking about the Romans, and he says, according to them, Christ does not intend everything he teaches in the fifth chapter to be regarded by his Christians as a command for them to observe, but he gave much of it merely as advice to those who want to become perfect. As he's talking directly to them. Then later on, he says, in the second place, there are the new jurists and sophists, the schismatic spirits and Anabaptists. That's the left wing. These are the Tolstoy people. From their crazy heads, they are making new trouble out of this fifth chapter. The others go too far to the left when they keep nothing at all of this teaching of Christ, but condemn and obliterate it. In the same way, these men lean too far to the right when they teach miserable stuff like this, that it is wrong to own private property. Jesus says, give your coat as well as your cloak. So they say, that means out with private property. To swear, to hold office as a ruler or judge, to protect or defend oneself, to stay with wife and children. So Luther comes up with an interpretation on the Sermon on the Mount, which he calls the doctrine of the two kingdoms. And Luther says there's the kingdom on the left and the kingdom on the right. God is king, Jesus is Lord, God is running his whole world, but he runs it in different ways. And the world, he runs, that's the kingdom on the left, he runs with the sword, with law, with order, with justice, with punishment. And then there's the kingdom on the right, and the kingdom on the right is the church, the family, and here he operates through love, interpersonal relationships, footsie-wootsie, and all of those kinds of things. But Luther says it's terribly important that God is ruling over both kingdoms. It's not that the kingdom on the left belongs to Satan and the kingdom on the right belongs to God. Both kingdoms belong to God. But he operates in different ways in those two kingdoms. So Luther says it is absolutely ridiculous to take the Sermon on the Mount and to try to build a government out of that. Because Luther says the Sermon on the Mount is for the kingdom on the right. He says you can't take that stuff and apply it to politics. And Luther is all talking about the executioner. That's kind of his big example. The executioner goes to the chopping block, you know, to the glory of God, because that's the kingdom on the left. And you have to chop those people's heads off because God operates through law and justice over there. But if you were to do that in your family, or if you were to do that in the Ladies' Aid, that would be inappropriate behavior because that's the kingdom on the right. So Luther builds up this whole business of the two kingdoms. Now, I think that theoretically, and as a kind of an overview, the doctrine of the two kingdoms is very helpful, kind of negatively, in order to counteract that Tolstoy Anabaptist absolutistic interpretation, on the one hand, and on the other hand, to combat this dualism of precepts and counsels that it's only for the super Christians on the right. Positively, when you try to put that into operation, I think it's very difficult. And a lot of people have said that one small element in the preparation for and development of the situation during the Nazi years of Germany was Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms, an extraordinary emphasis upon Romans 13, obey the powers that be, for they're ordained by God, that's the kingdom on the left. So, go to war, go to war. No worry at all. I'm a Christian, but I do what my government tells me. So that's a very tricky business, and I think that it's helpful negatively. Positively, it's not too helpful. Okay, that's some background stuff on the Sermon on the Mount. The problem gets to be, how do you read that thing? And that's the Word of God. Those are the words of Jesus. And what do you make of it? How do you take those words seriously without winding up as Tolstoy is did, out of your mind, or as the Anabaptists, the Amish people, and others have completely withdrawn from society in your own little super Christian club? How do you take that seriously? Well, Bonhoeffer was very interested in the Sermon on the Mount. And when he went to Finkenwalde to train these pastors for the Confessing Church, and he's very specific about this, and he's very, very explicit about it, he says that one thing that we must always have in the curriculum is the Sermon on the Mount. Now that's very interesting for a Lutheran pastor, because all the way back to 1517, Lutheran pastors have been trained on Romans and Galatians. You know, you can go to any Lutheran seminary, at least up until recently, and you know, you don't have, doesn't matter if you have a course on anything else, you have a full semester on Romans, full semester on Galatians, because that's justification by grace alone, and you've got to have that, you know, drilled into your head. Bonhoeffer says, Sermon on the Mount had better always be in the curriculum. So he always had that in the curriculum, and he wrote about it a lot, talked about it a lot, and the cost of his discipleship is his way of reading the Sermon on the Mount. So, we come to Bonhoeffer, and what is his thing? He sees in the Sermon on the Mount the basic problem as the problem of the relationship between faith and obedience. He says that if one is going to take those words seriously, that's the question that one has to face. Now, that's an old problem, and it's been handled in many different ways. Now, that's an old problem, and it's been handled in many different ways. Some of you have come out of the old ELC, and you know that the old ELC comes from the old NLCA, Norwegian Lutheran Church of America, which goes back to a union in 1917 of three groups, one of which believes in the first form of predestination, which says God saves those whom he predestines to be saved, period. And the Haugianers, who believe in the second form of predestination, which says God predestines those to be saved whom he foreknows will receive it. Well, the first form puts all the weight on God, the second form puts some little weight on man. And those two churches came together and fought about it for about 25 years and finally got tired and started talking about some other things. Buddhism has camp theology and monkey theology, the same issue, where a camp lifts up its young by the nape of the neck, and it just, you know, has nothing to do with it. Well, a monkey is baby hangs on for dear life while the mother swings from tree to tree. So there's a question of where you're going to put the emphasis of the kind of the faith and obedience problem. And so Bonhoeffer attacks that in his book on the Sermon on the Mount, and he says a number of different things. For instance, he talks about grace, and he says that everything is of grace. I mean, he's a camp theologian, in a way. He's not a monk theologian. It's not man hanging on to God, it's God hanging on to man. Herein we know love, not that we love God, but that God loved us. I mean, he's a Luther, grace alone man all the way through. But then he says, what do you mean, grace? He says, it's grace, but there is such a thing as cheap grace, and it's not cheap. Grace is costly. The problem of the church is not that we've talked about grace, but the problem of the church is that we've talked about grace in such a way that we've made it cheap instead of costly. And so he says, we Lutherans have gathered like eagles round the carcass of cheap grace, and there we have drunk the poison which has killed the life of following Christ. He says, cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance. It is baptism without church discipline. It is communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ. Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again, the gift which must be asked for, the door at which a man must knock. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly because it costs a man his life, and it is grace because it gives a man the only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin, and grace because it justifies the sinner. On and on and on and on. That's one important distinction Bonhoeffer makes when he talks about the Sermon on the Mount. He says there's a difference between cheap grace and costly grace. Okay, another thing that he does is to say that it is not the case that obedience follows faith. You see, he is really striking out at some very, very commonly held notion. He says the most commonly held notion is, first I believe, one, and then two, I obey. Bonhoeffer says you cannot do that, because as soon as you make faith one and obedience two, then you ask, what's the time interval? How long after I become a believer do I have to start obeying? And Bonhoeffer says that wrecks the whole business. So he says, obviously faith and obedience have to be distinguished, because faith is not obedience and obedience is not faith, but they may not be separated. So he says, only he who believes obeys, semicolon, only he who obeys believes, and that is absolutely reversible. I'll read you a little passage on that. It is quite unbiblical to hold only he who believes obeys, and only he who obeys believes. It is quite unbiblical to hold the first proposition without the second. We think we understand when we hear that obedience is possible only where there is faith. Does not obedience follow faith, as good fruit grows on a good tree? First faith, then obedience. If by that we mean that it is faith which justifies and not the act of obedience, all well and good, for that is the essential and unexceptionable presupposition of all that follows. If, however, we make a chronological distinction between faith and obedience, and make obedience subsequent to faith, We are divorcing the one from the other, and then we get the practical question, when must obedience begin? Obedience remains separated from faith, then. From the point of view of justification, it is necessary thus to separate them, but we must never lose sight of their essential unity, for faith is only real when there's obedience, never without it, and faith only becomes faith in the act of obedience. So Bonhoeffer would just absolutely flatly reject any notion that the Sermon on the Mount is a kind of helpful guide to a person after he becomes a Christian. You know, first you read Romans, you become a Christian, and then you think, wow, God has done this, all this for me. What can I do for you, God? I mean, I've got a free afternoon on Wednesday. And, well, Sermon on the Mount. Here are a few, you know, a few items you might try. Whatever, that's absolutely wrong, you know, to make that an A, B thing. The Sermon on the Mount is as integral to what Christian faith and life is about as is Romans and Galatians. Only he who believes obeys, semicolon, only he who obeys beliefs. That's another item. A third item, and I'll say a little bit about this, and then we can talk a while, is that he is just beautiful on the juxtaposition of visibility and hiddenness. And I'm not going to read these passages, but if you pick up the Cross of Discipleship, he has sections entitled The Visible Community, and then he has a section on the hidden righteousness. Chapter 5, you remember, Jesus says, you're the light of the world, and you're the salt of the earth. Bonhoeffer says, Jesus isn't saying you might someday become the light of the world. He says, you are the light of the world. He says, you're visible, for goodness sakes. And the whole business about the visible church and the invisible church, Bonhoeffer says, out with that noise. The church is visible. The church is people. The church is structure, institution. That's not in the sky somewhere. That's not invisible. It's visible. And he says to retreat into the realm of the invisible is to run away from Jesus Christ. Now, there are lots of implications in that. Then in chapter 6, he talks about hiddenness. And he says, that which is visible is at the same time hidden. That's not to say that which is visible is invisible, but it's hidden. So the chapter 6 is where Jesus says, he talks about praying and fasting and almsgiving. And he says, when you do it, go in the closet and pray. When you give alms, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. When you fast, wash your face, for goodness sake, so that no one knows it. And he says, and your Father who sees in secret, you do it in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Now, in the text, there's a period. In the King James Version, which is based on a text from Erasmus in the 13th century, which lots of junk had been added to through the years, there are the words added in the open. So that in those passages it says, and you do it in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you in the open. And those words were added to those passages because the Christians who read that couldn't stand to have their piety hidden. They wanted everybody to know we are Christians by our love, by our love. They couldn't stand it, that there was a period there, so they added the words in the open. And that's part of the whole Protestant ethics thing, of course. That faith has provable consequences. So if I really believe, if I really follow Jesus, then he's going to reward me in the open, And I mean, look at me, I'm prosperous. Obviously, I'm a man of faith. Right? Just the big bang in the United States of America. The text says, period. You do it in secret, and your Father, who sees you in secret, will reward you, period. And it's left ambiguous. It's visible, but it's hidden. And Bonhoeffer has beautiful things that he says on that, and that is very much in agreement with Karl Barth. One of Barth's favorite Bible verses is Colossians 3:3. Your life is hid with Christ in God. That's the only time Paul uses the phrase in God. He uses the phrase in Christ 150 times, in God once. Your life is hid with Christ in God. It's hid. It's hidden. Luther also played on that visibility hiddenness thing all the time. When he talked about God, he talked about God, the Deus Absconditus and the Deus Revelatus. God is always both revealed and hidden at the same time. Bread and wine is real bread and wine. That's as visible as anything can possibly be. In with and under, hidden, not invisible. The body of Christ is gathered there at the table, and the bread is as visible as can be, but in with another comes the body and blood of Christ. Jesus of Nazareth, my goodness, he was visible, but his sonship, his messiahship, was hidden. There are all kinds of people who saw everything that Jesus did, you know, as much as the disciples, and heard what he did. They said, the guy's a, you know, a roof from Nazareth, or he's a magician, or he's been monkeying around with the, you know, with the magician. Pentecost Day, they get up there and preach, and some people said, these guys are smashed, and it's only 9 o'clock in the morning. Other people say, well, what must we do to be saved? The entire Christian faith is built up of signs, ambiguous signs, that can be interpreted by unbelief or by faith. They're visible and they're hidden at the same time. And what Bonhoeffer does is to say that we have kind of gotten that straight a little bit theologically, but ethically we haven't. We're quite willing to let God and Jesus be visible and hidden, but we want our good works to be visible and unambiguous. And Bonhoeffer says, no. The Christian is as visible and hidden as Jesus himself is visible. And that's one reason why Bonhoeffer always comes down hard on confession. It is not the case that the Christian walks around and everybody looks at him and says, oh, wow, boy, do I want to be like that. Tell me, you know, how did you get that way? How come you're so nice? Well, it isn't like that. Huh? The faith is unprovable. It's undemonstrable. But that doesn't mean it's invisible. It's terribly visible. But faith, Christian faith, is not an explanation of those things we don't know. We talked about that yesterday morning. But faith is a total posture toward the totality of life. And the Sermon on the Mount is the words of Jesus indicating the seriousness of the Christian life. And they are kind of clues. Bonhoeffer doesn't say this, but if he heard me say it, he'd really like it. that it is. They are not absolute rules, you know, for all time and for, because nothing is timeless in the Christian faith. But they are. It's as though someone said, well, what does a Christian do? And some guy said, well, Christians do all kinds of things. And he said, yeah, I know, but like, for instance, well, let's go look at one. See? So you run after a Christian and you just follow him around with a movie camera. You just take a picture, you know, and And then you see this guy, and the postman comes up, and they were able to do this. They say, okay, now you have to carry the bag 1 mile. And for goodness sake, the guy carried it 2. Or the guy, and he's cold, and he asks him for his coat, and the guy gives him his, you know, his half coat too. So you take a movie of that Christian, and then you clip out one frame, you know, one frame of this. You just catch them just like that. And that's what those little things are. They're little pieces, of little segments of little slices of life from a Christian camera. And they're to be taken with utmost seriousness. And Jesus Christ is to be followed. Jesus Christ is to be obeyed. But they are not to be abstracted or universalized or absolutized as some kind of way of running society. Well, that's you know, kind of a bunch of stuff against the background of which maybe that book, The Cost of Discipleship, might perhaps be a little bit more readable for you, I hope. And do you have anything you'd like to say or questions raised? We've got some minutes to do that.
Are you saying we need to perhaps illustrate of principle?
I guess that I tend to shy away a little bit from the word principle, but I think rightly understood.
Yeah.
Bonhoeffer is a situation ethicist, and that's a whole big bag. But that position can be spelled out in many different ways, and all it says basically is that there are no rights and wrongs that are unconditioned by time and place. That time and place always feed into the rightness or the wrongness of an action. And principle tends to be a word that carries that kind of timeless connotation. And so I think that the word illustration or demonstration or sign or signal or clue, those are all, it seems to me, better words for the kind of things that we have in the Sermon on the Mount. Well, yeah. I tend to shy away from that word. The word principle, of course, can be loaded with kind of situational and contextual content, but generally it doesn't carry that. Yeah, well. Well, he's able to do it both ways. You know, like Paul, work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to do the good. He is quite able in a given situation to drive home only he who believes obeys, and in another situation only he who obeys believes. That's a kind of a law gospel thing, I suppose, in a way. But I don't think there is too much from him in that area, although when you say soul care or pastoral counseling, that was not a part of a normal curriculum or something in those days. But Bishop Otto Debelius, who died some years back, was in Berlin at the time that Bonhoeffer started teaching at the University of Berlin, and that he was a friend of the Bonhoeffer family, and Debelius told his father, as long as your son is going into the ministry, I think his real genius is for soul care, and that's what he should do. He shouldn't be a theologian, he should be a pastor. And it was Debelius that put him as chaplain to students at the Technical University in Charlottenburg. So I think that you could read Bonhoeffer from that point of view, and you can pick up lots of stuff. For instance, about 90% of the students from Finkenwalde died on the Eastern Front. And he writes letters to all of these families, and they're all, not all, but a good many of them are published and recorded. And he is able to pour out the grace and comfort of God like nobody's business, you know. But in this book, he's attempting to take seriously, and yet not in that literalistic way, the Sermon on the Mount, and so that's the way he does it. And I think that what he says here is of a piece with the whole non-religious Christianity thing and everything else, because it's always in terms of wholeness, never in terms of partiality.
I don't know if this is a school of thought or anything, but sometimes I've heard the Sermon on the Mount and an expression of God's standard, which we can always measure ourselves and try to achieve in the best possible way. And it, in that sense, drives us to realize our need of Christ, because we can't possibly do it.
I didn't mention that, but that is a very classic interpretation. There are about 20 others too. Schweitzer calls it an endromantic.
How would Von Tupper criticize that?
That's right. He would say that if one, in the first place, he is always against any way of talking about the Bible or the Christian faith or life in terms of an ideal to be strived after. In Life Together, for instance, he says over and over and over again, Christian community is not an ideal to be strived after, but a reality in which to participate. That whole business of striving after an ideal belongs to a two-sphere thinking idealistic tradition, which is precisely what Bonhoeffer is fighting against. So reality is a word that he uses all the time, set against the word ideal. He's always for the real, not the ideal. And so he says that if we read the Sermon on the Mount as some ideal to strive after, then we're making a Boy Scout ethic out of it. We're making, you know, it's just, you can buy that on at any corner candy store. The world is full of idealistic ethics that say, now here's really, you know, what you ought to try to do. And he says it's a lot more serious than that. It's not an ideal thing, it's a reality. It really does happen. And for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, it's all around us in the body. Jesus Christ. Well, the word rule, that depends on whether it's a disposable rule or whether rule means absolute forever and ever. If it's a disposable rule for a time and a place, then that word can be used. But Bonhoeffer always wants to talk about the Christian life in terms of obedience to Jesus Christ. And the concrete command is a word that he uses all the time, and that the command is never abstract. It's always concrete. It's always in a specific time and a specific place. Yeah, situational, contextual. Yeah.
How about obedience in terms of some people say obedience is the testimony or altar call or. In a general area, it's sort of what you call spiritual. Something I do in the church. I join the church, I have some responsibility, so I should sing in the choir, or I should be sensible. I have a feeling that probably getting your hands dirty on that. But.
Yeah, see, he's not against singing in the choir and reading. In fact, he's all for that, and he calls that the secret discipline. All of those things he's 100% for. But he says if one retreats into that, that's what he calls retreat into the invisible, that's nowhere, because Christian faith and life is for the whole of life. And that's his objection to Luther's reading of the Sermon on the Mount in terms of two kingdoms.
Well,
where you take the whole Sermon on the Mount and say, all right, that's for the kingdom on the right, and then you run the whole world of politics and state and government on the basis of justice and law.
That, you know, I think for instance, I'm on treasurer's sermon or promotion, my obedience is interpreted very explicitly to me in terms of my congregation. But I have a difficult time having somebody tell me how it, how I could be better out there. And
well, I think there are lots of goodies in the book entitled Ethics on that, and they're written by a man who got himself killed being a disciple for Christ in the dirty world of politics. So one item that I should mention, and that is that in the letter of the letters and papers from prison and the letter of July 21st, 1944, that's the day after he heard of the failure of the July 20th plot, he writes this, and we'll close with that. I remember a conversation that I had in America 13 years ago with a young French pastor. We were asking ourselves quite simply what we wanted to do with our lives. He said he would like to become a saint, and I think it's quite likely that he did become one. At that time, I was very impressed, but I disagreed with him and said, in effect, that I should like to learn to have faith. For a long time, I did not realize the depth of the contrast. I thought I could acquire faith by trying to live a holy life or something like it. I suppose I wrote The Cost of Discipleship at the end of that path. Today, I can see the dangers of that book, though I still stand by what I wrote. That's a kind of a key passage from the letters and papers, and it says that this is a stage in his development, and he does move from that, but he never rejects what he wrote there.